police crime data shows homicides and non-fatal shootings in Milwaukee are on the rise again this year after setting new records in 2020 and 2021. On May 13th, 21 people were injured in a series of shootings near the downtown Deer District, prompting calls for more action and investment in public safety. Here's Milwaukee Democratic State Senator LaTanya Johnson in a recent interview with PBS Wisconsin.
Every year this becomes a topic, especially for elected officials who represent Milwaukee. And we can never get help, never get help. But, you know, once it hits the Deer District, then it becomes an issue of concern during campaign time. And this is an issue of concern every single day for the people who live here.
Many communities around the country are dealing with gun violence issues similar to those in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How worried are you about gun violence in Wisconsin? What do you think, if anything, is making the problem worse? What solutions would you point to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Richard Rosenfeld is Curator's Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's a fellow and past president of the American Society of Criminology. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
A lot of different factors can go into rising gun violence. What do you see as potential likely causes that we see in communities around the country?
Well, I think two come immediately to mind. One, of course, is the pandemic. Milwaukee, as well as most other cities in the United States, saw a large homicide increase in 2020, the first year of the pandemic. And Milwaukee continued to go up last year, as did other cities on average, although the rate of increase slowed somewhat last year. And through the first quarter of this year, with respect to homicide rates, homicide is basically flat, no increase over the first quarter of last year. But that's an average, and some cities, evidently Milwaukee, are seeing an uptick in the first quarter of this year. Other cities have not.
I've talked to gun researchers, fatality researchers in the past who said, you know, we have multiple different problems. One might be mass shootings, like sadly we saw last week. One might be gun suicides. When it comes to the kind of crimes that are driving these statistics we're talking about in cities, is there, I guess, a modal situation, a typical situation where an argument leads into gun violence? What are the specific factors involved in a lot of these shootings?
It's a good question. And I would say the modal shooting situation has not changed, even though the rate of shootings has gone up over the last couple of years in Milwaukee and elsewhere. But the situation remains pretty much the same. The situation typically involves two young men, sometimes more, but basically two young men in an argument over any number of things. It could be an argument over money. If they're both involved in illegal activity, it could be an argument over the spoils from that activity. One dies in the encounter. That hasn't changed. That typical situation has remained pretty much the same over a long period of time. What has changed is the frequency of the fatalities that result from those situations.
Are there points where we could intervene, where we could find the people who are likely to be involved in these disputes that escalate in gun violence and, I don't know, turn them to another path of problem solving?
Yes, there are. There is a program that has been in existence now for several years. It goes under the title Focused Deterrence. And basically what it involves is identifying people at highest risk for becoming the next perpetrator or the next victim in an act of violence. And bringing those people into meetings with criminal justice officials, police, representatives of the prosecutor's office, judges, and with service providers. And often those meetings are also attended by family members of the individual and other members of their community, such as a local minister. And a two-prong message is delivered at those meetings. One is, we obviously know who you are, and we'll do everything within our power to ensure that you're not the next victim or the next perpetrator. And if you are the next perpetrator, we'll do everything in our power to make sure that you're punished for the behavior. Secondly, the message is, if you want out of this life, here are services and supports that can help. And the choice is yours. Those meetings turn out to be very effective in reducing the level of gun violence in the areas where they're held. And in a few studies, I've conducted one of them, we find that the participants in those meetings go on to accumulate fewer arrests than a randomly selected group of participants or persons who did not participate in the meetings. So we have good evidence that that program is effective. It's relatively low cost. Those meetings can be held frequently. They can be held wherever in the city the problem of gun violence or other problems, we're focusing on gun violence today, where those problems are heavily concentrated. So the answer to your question is yes, there are points of intervention that do appear to be effective.
There are calls often when we see any violent crime numbers go up for more police funding or more police. I wanted to ask you, is there a best way to use a finite resources? Is it putting more patrol officers on streets? Is it more community policing? Is it more homicide detectives or fill in the blank for me?
My answer is yes, yes, yes. So the sheer number of officers, while not unimportant, is less significant than where and how those officers are deployed. If they are deployed in those areas of the city, and these can be relatively small areas, where gun violence is heavily concentrated or where it has recently increased, elevating patrols in those areas, the research suggests, does tend to reduce gun violence. And by the way, without spreading it to other areas where the patrols have not been beefed up. Now, having said that, that approach has been criticized regardless of its effectiveness in reducing gun violence, it can often, the critics say, result in needless harassment of the young men in the community when there are more police officers around. And that obviously has to be avoided. And there's good research suggesting that it can be avoided. So this is an approach that does not necessarily have negative consequences for the communities in which it operates and can reduce gun violence.
We're talking about gun violence in Milwaukee and other communities with University of Missouri St. Louis criminology professor Rick Rosenfeld. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see gun violence addressed in communities like Milwaukee? Do you think there needs to be more of a police presence? Does that mean more funding? What is your solution? What's your experience with this issue? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Rick Rosenfeld, Professor Emeritus of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, with us today looking at some of the causes and possible solutions for gun violence in large cities like Milwaukee, where over the last couple of years we saw the numbers unfortunately go up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your questions about gun violence? How would you like to see communities address the issue? How would you like to see police departments address the issue? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We got an email from Linda who writes, in my opinion, the most urgent plan of action would be to ban all assault-type rifles across the board. That would be a start in the right direction. Rick, I know with targeted mass shootings, the ones with the high fatalities that we see in the news, those are often the weapons we're talking about. In our conversation now, that escalating violence, do we know what kind of firearms are most typically used?
There's a variety, but I think the important point, this goes to the issue raised by your listener, is that over time, the fraction of weapons used in crime on the streets involve automatic or semi-automatic type weapons with large capacity magazines, that fraction has gone up over time. And I do think that one of the reasons we're seeing more homicides, not just in the last couple of years, but going back some time, is the fact that these types of weapons, these more lethal weapons, are more frequently used. And that means the shooter can get off more rounds in a relatively short period of time. And the more rounds that are discharged, the more likely it is that someone will be hit or killed. So the lethality of the firearm and the use of these more lethal weapons is not an issue that's specific to mass shootings, though clearly a salient issue in that respect. But it's an issue that affects homicide rates generally.
I should ask about relationships between police departments and communities and cities, especially communities of color. We've just had the couple-year anniversary now of the death of George Floyd. How big a part of the story do you think that that lack of, I guess, trust between communities can be part of this story?
I think it's in a very, very important part of the story. There's reason to believe that the sharp increase we saw in homicides and other forms of gun violence in 2020 was connected to the widespread disaffection with the police after the George Floyd killing. In my own research, what I found is that in most cities, the homicide rate rose sharply, not at the beginning of the pandemic or even in the first month or two, but in the week following George Floyd's killing on May 25th, 2020. And that elevated rate persisted through the summer and into the early fall. So what was happening then? Widespread demonstrations across the country against police violence, police misconduct, greater calls for police accountability. And under those conditions, what in my business is called police legitimacy, the perceived fairness and effectiveness of the police diminishes, especially in those communities where police-related violence tends to be concentrated. And as fewer people have confidence in the police, they're less likely to engage with the police, less likely to cooperate in investigations, less likely to notify the police if they become aware of a crime being committed. And all of that puts upward pressure on crime rates. So police community relations has to be at the top of anybody's list of areas that really do require reform.
And briefly, just in our last minute or so, the ubiquity of guns. Is there a sort of a game theory here where if I know my somebody I'm in an argument has a gun, they know I have a gun. Is that incentivizing being the first one to escalate to using a gun? Is that part of the story?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Yeah, absolutely. No matter who you ask, you can ask law-abiding people, or you can ask people who use guns in the commission of a crime, why did you purchase the gun? The overwhelming answer, no matter who you ask, is for my own protection while out on the streets or indeed in my home. And that, why do people purchase a gun? For their own protection, because of their perception that guns are out there. And if they don't have a weapon of that sort, they could be on the losing end of an encounter. So the ubiquity of guns is self-generating, as you suggest, and it is a major problem.
We'll leave it there, Rick. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Richard Rosenfeld is Curator's Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's a fellow and past president of the American Society of Criminology. He joins us today to try to help us better understand gun violence in large cities around the country, including Milwaukee. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about finding a connection with nature.
Sometimes an experience touches us in ways we never would have imagined. Over a long Memorial Day weekend, writer Ron Weber witnessed a doe mourning the loss of her fawn, causing him to reflect on the similarities and connections between humans and nature.
Though sunny weather was forecast, my Memorial Day weekend plans did not include picnics or fishing. Yard chores and planting the garden was my fate. Pulling in the driveway Friday after work, I saw my neighbor had cut his first crop of hay. That aroma reminded me of the plethora of sights and smells that make this month of rebirth such a joy, and how much even we humans live with the rhythm of the seasons. Just after supper, as I walked towards the garden, I saw a deer in the field. With deer so plentiful, I never gave it a second look. Finishing my task an hour later, I saw the deer had not moved. Then I knew. Rising just after dawn, the deer was my first thought. I went to an upstairs window, hoping for an empty field. That hope was dashed when I saw a deer walking close to where I had seen it the evening before. I watched the doe walk through the field searching, until I couldn't watch anymore, so I distracted myself with breakfast. Working around the yard, I paused often to look in the field. Each time, there she was. Though often in the area I had first seen her, she also walked the perimeter and through the field searching, and I surmised, hoping. I was still hoping, too, when about 1 p.m., an eagle circled twice and glided to a landing 10 yards from the doe. It took a couple short hops and began feeding. The doe looked on as the eagle feasted. There was no denying my own sadness now. The eagle fed for a bit and took wing. The doe approached with her head low, and there she stood. As dark crept over the field, she was standing near where the eagle had fed. Call it instinct, dedication, love, whatever it was something to behold. A restless night of sleep followed. In the morning, I rose and headed for the window. I saw a large animal I thought at first glance was a wolf. Instead, it was a big coyote enjoying the spoils. The doe was standing 30 yards away. She sidled in until finally the coyote would have no more. It feigned a charge which sent the doe running. It returned to feed for another 5 minutes before racing towards the woods. The doe made her way back, and there she stood. That evening, I helped my wife prepare a new flower bed. Carrying weeds and sticks to the corner of our yard, through a gap in two spruce trees, I saw a deer 20 yards away in the field. Our eyes locked. I still recall what I saw in those eyes. It was sadness. Was it just the doe's, or a reflection of mine as well? I'm not sure. I tossed my load under the spruce. The doe never moved. I dropped my eyes, turned, walked away, and never looked back. Darkness mercifully came. That evening, I realized I knew better what Alden Leopold meant when he wrote, "For one species to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun."
I dozed off and slept like a rock. The next morning, the doe was gone. At noon, the farmer baled the hay. The curtain had fallen on this play. The stage was cleared and the actors left. In my memory, I would save the ticket stub from my weekend with the doe, in which I learned more not only about the nature of animals, but human nature as well.
Ron Weber is a writer and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.